The next case is 07-1090, disciplinary counsel versus Scott R. Roberts. Mr. Caligari.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. My name is Joseph Caligari. I represent the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. The sole issue before this court today concerns the appropriate sanction for an attorney that has engaged in multiple acts of dishonest conduct. There are three reasons why this court should reject the board's recommended sanction of a public reprimand and instead impose a 6-month stayed suspension upon the respondent, Scott Roberts. The first reason is simply that the respondent and his counsel and relator before the hearing stipulated that the appropriate sanction based upon respondent's misconduct would be a 6-month stayed suspension. The case law that was cited in the hearing was Columbus Bar Association versus Daugherty. That was the same case that was available to the respondent at the time they entered into the stipulation that the 6-month stayed suspension was appropriate. The second reason why this court should reject the board's recommendation of a reprimand is because the conduct in this case warrants a stiffer penalty. This was not an isolated incident of misconduct. As the board found, there were multiple offenses. This was not the run-of-the-mill notary case where an attorney simply witnessed a signature without the affiant being present. The first allegation of misconduct alone would warrant a public reprimand. And in that incident, in March of 2004, the respondent's client was sent a wage release to execute. That client signed the document but failed to have it notarized. The client then sent that wage release directly to the employer. The employer realized that the signature had not been notarized, and so the employer sent that wage release back to the respondent with instruction to have it notarized by his client. Rather than do that, the respondent simply cut corners, changed the date of his client's signature by crossing it out from March 8th to March 21st, and then he simply notarized it as being a genuine signature and sent it back to the employer. Again, that conduct alone would warrant a reprimand in this court based on precedent. But the second act of misconduct was even more egregious, and it involved multiple acts of dishonesty. 6 months after this first incident, the respondent sent to his client a general release of all claims against Cincinnati Insurance Company. The client, rather than sending that release to the client, the respondent, Mr. Roberts, simply forged his client's signatures, both the husband and the wife, to the release. He then notarized the signatures that he had just forged as being genuine. He then induced his office manager to sign as a witness to the forgeries as though they were genuine. And then, to make matters worse, he sent a letter back to the insurance company with the enclosed release stating that his clients had executed the release and sent that back to the insurance company. So just in that second count, there's 4 instances of dishonest conduct. And the third reason why this court should reject the board's recommendation of a reprimand is simply because a 6-month stayed suspension is completely consistent with this court's previous decisions involving notary cases. Most notably, disciplinary counsel versus Howard Freeman, which was a case in which an attorney sought a loan from a client, and the loan required collateral of a second mortgage owned by the respondent, lawyer, and his wife. The respondent lawyer induced his associate to notarize his signature, which she did in his presence, and then after the fact that the lawyer notarized his signature, he then added his wife's name after the attorney, the associate, hired to notarize his signature. So it appeared that the attorney associate had notarized the husband and wife's signature.
Mr. Caligari, in your brief, You mentioned that if he had done this correctly, that is the release, particularly the release, had the client sign it, that Mr. Jacobs, I forget his name, Mr. the claimant, that he perhaps would not have had the experience of his wife taking the money and leaving him. Mr. Mann, of course, objects to that or takes issue with that conclusion. Is there anything in the record that suggests that if he had known more about what was going on, that perhaps he wouldn't have been the victim of his wife's mishandling of their funds?
Your Honor, in response to that question, the only evidence in the record came from a question from a panel member. And because the respondent and his counsel were arguing that there was nothing that they could have done to prevent the fraud. Basically, the wife stole all the money that the respondent had sent. And the question from the panel member was, well, had you done things correctly and brought the client in to sign the release in front of you and handed him the check, it would have been less likely that money would have been stolen. In other words, the wife would have maybe had less of an opportunity to abscond. That's the only evidence that was in the record.
Here it sounds as if from the record that these were very poor people who lived out in the hinterlands in Michigan someplace, I guess, and they couldn't drive. Certainly, it sounds from the record they couldn't even drive into the city to do what they needed to do. It was unlikely they would have driven to Columbus, I guess. He would have had to go there, probably. But that's correct.
Or if the other, I think, scenario, and again, as Mr. Mann pointed out, it is conjecture, but it's very plausible. Had the respondent sent the release to his client and had the signature notarized, the client would have been on notice that this check was coming. So I think there's that potential. The other issue that I would just touch on briefly is this case was fully stipulated. Factually, the violations were stipulated, and the recommended sanction of a 6-month state suspension was stipulated. So the only person that testified at the hearing was the respondent. And so there was no opportunity to really contrast anything that was said, but if you read the record, some of the testimony is just, it's simply inconsistent. For instance, Mr. Roberts said, well, you know, his clients had told him that they could sign the name because they couldn't get in town to get this document notarized. On the other hand, he stated that his clients were driving 1,000 miles a week to obtain medical care. So just that one point is inconsistent. So when you have just the respondent testifying, it's a little difficult to determine exactly what happened and what may have been prevented. We don't dispute the fact that Mr. Roberts was not acting out of any dishonest or selfish motive. This was a convenience for his clients, but it was multiple deliberate acts of deception aimed at alleviating the responsibilities of a notary public.
One of your arguments would be, I didn't see it here, maybe I missed it, but that we seem to see every now and then, more frequently than we should, an abuse of the notary public authority of a lawyer in notarizing documents and causing others to witness documents when it's fraudulent. And I guess the argument would be that a public reprimand is, we can't seem to get the message through to some lawyers that you simply cannot do that. And yet we see it happening because, as you know, the case is cited that we've done both, given suspended sanctions and also public reprimands. Is that part of what you see in this case? This is more than just one incident where a lawyer misuses the notary authority, but there is somewhat of a pattern here with these clients, at least, not other clients. But is that a part of your argument, or is that something we should be interested in?
Thank you. I do think the court should be interested in that. First of all, in this case, had we been limited to just the first allegation where he notarized the signature of the client without the client being in his presence, Relator would be advocating for a public reprimand. But this case goes way beyond that. There's a forgery, there's then another improper notarization, there's inducement on an office assistant to engage in fraud.
Yeah, that one, to me, that's certainly as bad as to me as a notary, requiring an office person over whom you have control to do something illegal seems to be a rather serious matter.
Right, and I think this court needs to send the message that type of conduct, going one step further, really undermines the integrity of the profession. And Mr. Roberts himself has admitted that, that his acts have undermined the integrity of the legal profession. And they rely heavily on the case of Columbus Bar Association versus Daugherty, which was a 2005 case, again, that was available at the time the stipulation was entered into regarding the sanction. But that case was a 4-3 decision. The three dissenting justices would have imposed an actual 6-month suspension, and that involved an isolated incident of misconduct where an attorney simply signed as a notary, despite the fact that the client did not sign the affidavit in the lawyer's presence. And that turned out to be a forgery, but there was no knowledge of it by the lawyer. And the distinction with Daugherty is it states right in the case, we're imposing a public reprimand based upon the fact that there was no forgery, no knowledge of a forgery, or no other conduct beyond just failing to witness a signature in the lawyer's presence. So here we have a forgery, we have a knowledge of a forgery, and then we have conduct that goes beyond the witnessing. So clearly, based on the precedent, this court should reject the board's recommended sanction of a reprimand and impose a 6-month stayed suspension. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Caligiuri. Mr. Mann.
Mr. Chief Justice Moyer, and may it please the court, Scott Roberts has always admitted that he violated two disciplinary rules. He has always expressed great contrition about those violations. Nothing that I say this morning is intended to try to excuse those violations, but rather to put the context, or to put Mr. Roberts' actions into the context of what actually happened in this real life case. What happened was, in an effort to rush desperately needed financial help to clients who were literally in very desperate shape, about to lose their house, about to not have food on the table, not able to buy gas, not able to keep utilities on, not the heat, not able to have the phone on consistently. In an effort to do that, he allowed his heart to control his head. He knows that was wrong. He has always said that was wrong. And because he allowed his heart to control his head to help these people who were literally on the brink, we're here today. As has been pointed out, the only dispute in this case is the sanction. The board and the hearing panel stated it should be a public reprimand, and we believe it should be a public reprimand because Mr. Roberts has always admitted what he did was wrong from day one. He has taken full, total, complete responsibility for his misconduct.
Well, counsel, let me ask you a question about what you just said about the urgency of and this was the motivation for it. He had the limited power of attorney to settle the first case with GEICO?
He had a limited power of attorney to do both cases, but the power of attorney wasn't notarized.
Okay, so that was, they had a receipt then of almost $40,000 in September, is that correct?
I'm not sure the date, but they got $47,000 approximately from Cincinnati Insurance.
Which was later in October. At the end of the year, they were getting the $47,000, but they got about $39,000 from GEICO at first.
I believe that's a net number after payment of medical bills and so forth.
The net number of $39,000 from GEICO and then the $47,000 from Cincinnati.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, plus the PIP payment.
Okay.
Of about $18,000.
All right. Well, if he admits that his second biggest mistake was how he handled the Cincinnati insurance for the $47,500, and these people already had almost $40,000 in their possession to presumably stop the pressure at that point of losing their car and house and all that kind of stuff. So when you say that it was an urgent situation in October for him to deal with the Cincinnati insurance, I don't see that as being a genuine motivation. I could see maybe more if he was working on the first check to get to these people to put food on the table and gas in the car and stave off the, you know, wolf from the door. But I don't see it as a justification for the second go-around.
Well, it's certainly possible possible that the clients were frauds and liars and were just lying to Mr. Roberts about this. But what happened was these folks were living paycheck to paycheck. They're kind of poor people who live way out in the rural part of Michigan, way up the northern part. They had no health insurance. The accident happened in January. Right away, they had in January over $18,000 in medical bills. Mr. Carter could not work, so they have no money coming in at all. Then Mrs. Carter, who had a part-time job, I believe, in a florist shop, she couldn't work because she had to take Mr. Carter, and it was sometimes a thousand miles a week for medical care. And we actually introduced an exhibit at the trial with the names of the medical providers and showed on a map how far it was. It was an enormous distance. So these people were in difficult financial situation, paycheck to paycheck, right at bat. And then when this happened, right away, $18,000 in medical bills just at the hospital, the first hospitalization, no money coming in for either of them, no health insurance. I think it's very plausible for Mr. Roberts to believe what the client said, that they were in desperate financial condition, but it is possible that they lied to him. There are two aggravating factors in this case, and those are the two admitted violations. The stipulated mitigating factors are absence of any prior record, disciplinary record, and Mr. Roberts has been practicing about 28 years, absence of any dishonest or selfish motive. It was stipulated. He did this to help these people, not to help himself. Full and free disclosure to the disciplinary authorities and a cooperative attitude. And the last stipulated mitigating factor was that Mr. Roberts is a person of good character and reputation. Further, as noted at page 5 of the board's opinion or report, the board was particularly impressed with Mr. Roberts' willingness to take full, total, and complete responsibility for everything he had done wrong. And if the panel has time to go back and reread his testimony, I don't think it was possible for him to be more contrite, more sorry, angry at himself for what he did, and totally apologetic for what he did. Given these facts, and given, as our friends at the disciplinary counsel's office has noted at page 4 of its brief, it's well settled that under these types of circumstances, or certain circumstances, something less than a full suspension is appropriate. And in the Doherty case, is just one case, there was a forged affidavit on a liquor permit, and I believe, well, it was a notarized a signature that I believe it later turned out to be forged. In Cleveland Bar versus Russell, there was a signature on two
deeds.
But
that forgery was not done by the attorney.
Yes, ma'am. That's true. In the Russell case, there were two deeds, and to use our friend's argument, that's a course of conduct case. In Mahoning County Bar versus Melnick, another public reprimand case, there were three affidavits. And again, to use our friend's example, that's a course of conduct of three instances.
Counsel, on the first instance where the release form came back without a notary and he calls back, he just talked to the wife, right?
Right. He just...
Was the husband around at that time?
When Mr. Roberts first met with these folks on January 14th up at their home, Elmer Carter, Mr. Carter said,
yeah,
talk to my wife.
I know about that, but...
And Mr. Carter
would be in a less
Scott.
On that one, he would be in a less precarious position if he'd said, get Elmer on the phone.
And he did...
Elmer, I've got this form here. Got your signature on that. Is that your signature?
Your Honor is correct. In February of 04, he did talk to Elmer on the phone, and Elmer said, I told you before,
yeah,
talk to my wife.
Okay.
So,
and that signature turned out to be Elmer's signature.
As far as we know.
There's no indication that the wife had
I can only tell you, as far as we know, it's his signature, which leads to an interesting point, Your Honor, and this goes to the Chief Justice's question. Even if we would assume, for the sake of argument, that Mr. Roberts did it right, and he sent the PIP release and the Cincinnati release up to these folks, and he said, I don't care how poor you are. If you have to hitchhike into town and get your signatures notarized, if we're going to speculate, then we can speculate that Mrs. Carter could have just taken those documents, forged Mr. and Mrs.'s signature and the notary signature. So my only point on that, to follow up on what the Chief Justice, his question and Your Honor's question, is once we start down the road of conjecture, what might have happened versus what's really in the record, we could come to literally an infinite number of possible conclusions.
The other question I have relates to what you're all here arguing about, and that is the penalty. And in the stipulations, while there is not a stipulated penalty, there is a stipulation that both sides would recommend the penalty that the disciplinary council is now asking us to impose. Is that correct?
I believe, to be totally honest with the court, as Mr. Caligiuri has pointed out, originally there was a discipline by consent with a proposed 6-month suspension stayed. We did that, frankly, because Mr. Roberts is extremely upset at himself and very angry at himself for putting himself in this position. And he was very hard on himself in his testimony. Secondly, to save fees, the board rejected the discipline by consent and said, you must try this case. And we said, fine, those are the rules. I would point out, if we adopt Mr. Caligiuri's argument, our friend's argument, as a practical matter, if you enter into a stipulation and the board rejects it, but then it's still binding on you, that's the end of discipline by consent.
No, I'm not suggesting it's still binding on you, but apparently at one point your client thought that was a fair outcome.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely true. In order to, one, put this matter behind him, he's extremely angry at himself, very, very upset at himself for getting himself in this situation, and for those psychological reasons, he wants to get it behind him. And two, frankly, I indicated I thought it was a public reprimand case. Do you want to pay me to prove that? And he counseled with his brother and other people and made what I thought was a rational decision. But once the board said we don't accept that, we had no choice but to go forward.
What is your, Mr. Mann, what is your, what are your thoughts about his, I guess, ordering his member of his staff to witness, illegally witness a document that hadn't been properly signed? Is that, should we be concerned about that?
Yes. Very bad, very stupid, not acceptable, and as Mr. Roberts said in his testimony, the reason I was so stupid is this actually strikes at the integrity of the legal system, what I did here. And we can't have that. He said, he testified, we cannot allow the ends to justify the means. And that's why I'm so, and these are his words, these are not my words, he said, that's why I was so very, very stupid, and I'm paraphrasing now, to let my heart control my head, to get help to these people who, as the justice pointed out, may have been lying the whole time, but I think it's entirely plausible that their story was true.
Was there any, I assume there was, neither of you mentioned your briefs, is there any mention in the record about the fact that when he forged the signatures on the release, he gets the check from the insurance company quicker than if he sends it up to them and wonders whether he's going to get it back or not and properly executed? Was there any suggestion of, I mean, we're all assuming that he did all of this to help these poor people up in northern Michigan who couldn't drive to get something notarized, but he did benefit, did he not, from having this release executed and give, I assume the insurance company wasn't going to give a check till they got the release. That would be unusual, I would guess.
I think the check actually came with the release, if I'm not mistaken. If I am, I would ask my friend to correct me. Of course, the check didn't need to be notarized so the clients could sign it. And it's our understanding, and again, I'd ask my friend Mr. Caligiuri, if I'm wrong, to correct me, Mr. Carter, unless Mrs. Carter forged his signature when that was mailed up there, signed these documents. As far as we know, Mr. Carter signed the final check. The check made out, the final check in the case made out to Elmer and Suzanne Carter, which was signed on the back, deposited in the joint.
He trusted her to deposit it, not take it then out from him and run and
it was
leave him.
Put in the joint account, and at some point in time later, we don't know if it was a day, a week, a month, 2 months, we don't know exactly why it, well, we don't know why. We don't know what precipitated Mrs. Carter doing what she's doing with the stipulated fact is she stole the money. The money was gone. Unless the members of the court have any further questions for me, I'll just briefly sum up by saying a lawyer who is engaged in misleading conduct should not be suspended where he freely admits his misconduct, takes full responsibility, is totally cooperative in the disciplinary proceedings, and where the mitigating factors in the case substantially outweigh the aggravating factors. So we would respectfully ask that this honorable court follow the recommendation of the panel and the board and impose a public reprimand on Mr. Roberts. Thank you all very much. Thank you,
Mr. Mann. Mr. Caligiuri, you've saved about 4.5 minutes of your time.
I would just like to address a couple of points. First, Justice O'Connor, I believe Mr. Mann had stated that the limited power of attorney applied to both claims, but actually the limited power of attorney only applied to the GEICO claim, not to the Cincinnati insurance claim. And then in response to Justice Pfeiffer's question regarding the stipulation, if you follow along with respondent's argument that he entered into the stipulation based upon the fact that he was embarrassed by the misconduct, he was upset at himself, rightly so, and that he wanted to save on fees of fighting this. Once it was rejected as a consent to discipline agreement, as Mr. Mann stated, they had no choice but to go forward. But even after that choice was imposed upon them by having to go forward, he again entered into a stipulation that was presented to the board that his conduct, the appropriate sanction or recommendation would be a 6-month stayed suspension. Other than that, I have nothing further.
Thank you, Mr. Caligiuri. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.